7. 8 hours and around 4,000 miles from the Action Now Ecological Convention. The cream leather upholstery had been smooth under Link's fingertips, and the glass refrigerator was well stocked with glittering bottles. Link felt ready in his blood and his bones. The plans were underway. As agreed in the evacuation protocol, the pilot had given false headings to air traffic control as soon as they were out of radar range. Whatever was coming, he was ready for it. A short flight with these two panicking bozos, then his own private plane and Martha and the island and the start of the world to come. In the air, they had hooked up to the plane's Wi-Fi and tried to find out what could possibly be coming. Augur indicated that hotspots to avoid on the journey were Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Mexico, Texas, France. Zimri connected to the many information tentacles of Anvil. Ellen searched Medlar torque data. Lenk looked at the detailed analytics for posts on Fantail. Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Mexico, Texas, France. Ordering patterns. Search patterns. Words used in reviews, in emails to vendors, in social media posts, in queries to Fantail Pal talk bots. Heart rates, blood solutes, physical activity, smiley faces, frowny faces, a proxy for the thoughts and feelings of the human planet, more or less. Some patterns had started to emerge. Shit! Said Ellen Bywater, pointing at a particular pattern of medlar torque biodata. Shit, shit, shit! Once they knew what they were looking for, it wasn't too difficult. A set of search terms on Fantail Live, and there, yes, in the background of certain videos, you could already see what was coming. Lenk Sketlish felt the news drain through him like immersion in cold water. He felt extraordinarily calm, peaceful even. If this was the story, then there might have been nothing they could do anyway. The sound was so loud and so sudden that it seemed to be coming not from outside but from inside them, as if their own hearts had shattered their chests. It was an all-encompassing, terrifying noise. It sounded like the end of days, the Lord's vengeance. Each of them lurched forward in their seats as the nose pointed downward, their seatbelts like metal bars cutting into their torsos, making them retch with sudden gastric acid pushed back up their throats. There was a terrible sound, a wrenching, strained sound, a bang, and then a yawning moan of bolt and screw. An automatic voice said, "Please retrieve your crash jacket from underneath your seat. Unroll it and place it over your head. It will self-secure around your waist. Try to remain calm." Lenk pressed the intercom button on his seat. "What the fuck? What the fuck is happening? Was that an explosion? What's happened?" The pilot said through the intercom, "I don't know. Malfunction. Could be weapons fired. I didn't see anything. We need to get away." He sounded terrified. Lenk Sketlish, Ellen Bywater, and Zimri Nomik pulled at their seatbelts, trying to loosen them, trying to retrieve their crash jackets from underneath their seats, trying to find the fucking head hole. The pilot said, "I think we're under attack. I'm not sure. I'm releasing countermeasures. Please. I'm going to do what I can, but you have to get ready to jump." This was not an aircraft with offensive capabilities. It was a private plane, which, because it was owned by a paranoid man, was equipped with a very limited number of countermeasures. Outside, it was night. 2 in the morning local time, darkness and a great moon full and fat. Through his window by the moonlight, Lenk saw a cloud of silver metal radar baffling strips release into the air, like a squid jetting ink to confuse a predator. The darkly glinting pieces reflected the light from the moon, from the plane itself. The plane was diving now. There was no siren. The sound in Lenk's ears was the sound of his heartbeat. His cold, shaking fingers found the hole in the center of the crash jacket at last and unrolled it over his head. He fitted the emergency oxygen mask in the center of the crash jacket over his mouth and nose and tried to breathe normally. He remembered, as if a memory from a distant world, a woman with a nose whistle telling him to breathe from his navel. That had been just after he'd woken up that actual morning. Like breathing normally right now, breathing from the navel was literally impossible. The plane banked sharply to the left and the right. There was a sound from the back of the hull. The emergency doors popped open. Time was very fast and very slow. Lenk thought of inert submunition dispensers, a very neutral name for a particular kind of missile held to be more ethical because they didn't scatter explosive material over civilians. Each missile held a small canister of inert material under high compression. When it exploded, hundreds of razor-sharp metal loops expanded in a wide sphere centered around the empty space filled with noise. It was the pressure and the speed that made them dangerous. Less than 1 second after they were released, the metal loops would be nothing but debris. No mines left to maim children. No nuclear wasteland. Released into the air, they would mostly describe a parabola and fall harmlessly to Earth, tiny pieces of innocuous wire. Medlar had created some chips for them. Anvil had undertaken transportation logistics. Fantail had agreed to censor mention of them for certain regimes around the world. Looked at in a certain light, inert submunition dispensers were almost good news. And if you were under attack by inert submunition dispensers in the dark, it would feel like this. Nothing to see, only a sound and a plane taking itself to pieces. There was a second explosion. Where there had been a solid metal hull, there was a line drawn by cheese wire over and around the seats. They were breached. The breach began to open. The sound was a shriek of metal on metal. There was spin and counterspin within the plane, the hull rotating, turning the world upside down and right side up, upside down and right side up. The sound of rending as the aircraft pulled apart. It turned from a gliding vessel to two connected metal tubes, each weighing nearly 500,000 pounds, placed 35,000 feet above the Earth's surface, like a broken jelly roll floating in midair, doing what a broken jelly roll was likely to do in these circumstances. "Now," said the crash jackets, "undo your seatbelt, run toward the emergency door, throw yourself out with all your strength. The chute will automatically inflate when you are far enough from the plane." Ellen was already climbing up the spinning plane, finding footholds on the seats and luggage storage, controlled in her movements like a woman who'd spent summers bouldering in Yosemite. She'd panicked when she had to pack up, but in the final analysis, she never hesitated to act decisively. She was the first off the plane. Zimri was slower, moving crabwise, clinging on. He quickly figured out a new method of movement, holding the seatbelt tight in his clenched jaw to give himself an extra point of contact. He grabbed a second crash jacket from under an empty seat just to be on the safe side. Lenk was the last out, still looking around as if he could figure out what had happened here. His final thought as he hauled himself by the seats toward the emergency door was, "We gave false information to air traffic control. If anyone's left alive to look for us, they'll be looking in the wrong place."
"So," said Shin, "some random nation fired a tech bomb at you, and you ended up here. What were you saying about an army?"
"Doesn't it strike you as suspicious," said Lenk, "that we should have been shot down precisely here, over an uninhabited island capable of sustaining us indefinitely?"
"Yeah," said Shin. "I guess so. But also maybe just lucky?"
"I've been thinking about this for the past 3 weeks. If it was an inert submunition dispenser, only a limited number of nations have access to them. Papua New Guinea, the nearest nation to Admiral Hunsey Island, definitely doesn't have any.
So
I wouldn't be thinking this way if we hadn't been taken down by an advanced technology. It was too early for anyone to be really panicking. Do you understand? No one knew about the plague yet. That was the whole point. Only we knew there was anything to be afraid of. No ordinary army would have taken down our plane. It would be the kind of army you have if you don't have to rely on human beings."
Lenk stood up and pulled his shorts back on.
Listen, he said. You slept with Martha, and I guess that makes us as close to family as either of us has on this island. If Martha trusts you, if she gave you Augur even for a few days, you're probably the most trustworthy person here for me, which is not saying much. So, Medlar has inert submunition dispensers, drone-mounted for use in civilian breakdown situations. So does Anvil, so do we, Fantail. It was all agreed with a lot of different governments after the last plague, that we ought to be able to help if there was civil unrest. He stepped backward into his suit, the shins and torso neatly sealing around him. Jun understood what Lank was doing. He was bringing her into his tight circle of information, but he was also letting her know what her position was. She was on this island with three people who each had access to weapons and resources she had never even heard of. After the end of the world, what possible reason was there for any of them to want her alive? I know Fantail didn't bring down the plane, so I think it was one of them. Knowing we had the crash jackets and the suits, knowing we'd survive, knowing we'd end up here. Knowing that, terrible as it is, a plague like this brings unparalleled opportunities for whoever walks into that new future alive. I think one of them wants to be king of the fucking world, which is easier if I'm dead. So I don't trust them, okay? The visor slid across Lank's face, leaving Jun looking straight into the eyes of her own reflection.